This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Coming up on today's show, how to attract more pollinators to your yard and garden. First up, college campuses have a history of supporting and protecting free speech and the open exchange of new ideas. But on campuses across the country, arguments over what type of speech should be allowed are becoming more frequent and increasingly turning violent. Next Tuesday, the Beyond Civility Initiative will present a forum on free speech, campus protests, and public safety. And joining us this afternoon to discuss free speech on campus are senior mediator for the Center for Resolution of Disputes and co-founder of Beyond Civility, B. Larson, Mount St. Joseph University President, Dr. H. James Williams, Dr. John Paul Wright, professor in the University of Cincinnati School of Criminal Justice, and Jack Greiner, attorney with the Graydon Law Firm. He also represents Inquirer Media and First Amendment and media issues. You can join us, 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And James, John, Jack, and B, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. Much appreciated.
Thank you.
Welcome.
B,
thanks, Mark.
Tell us why Beyond Civility decided to delve into this issue of free speech on college campuses.
Well, our mission at Beyond Civility is to enhance communication for governance. And we define governance very broadly, not just in a political sense, but also the policymakers in our community, how they're addressing the important issues of the day, and to try to bring in both sides of every issue so that we can gain some greater understanding of where people are coming from.
Fair to say that Beyond Civility is about free speech then.
In a sense.
In a sense.
Yes.
Yeah. Jack, there have been a lot of battles over free speech on college campuses for decades. So how is this latest incarnation, this latest version that we're seeing, how is it different from what we've seen in the past?
I think in some respects it's come 180 degrees, and probably that's best illustrated by the experience of Berkeley, which in 1964 was the center of the free speech, the campus free speech movement, which was to foster the ability of students and others to talk about anti-war stance and protest and that sort of thing. And now in 2017... that same campus has been involved in efforts to disinvite speakers, including Milo Yiannopoulos, Ann Coulter, and it's as if it's come 180 degrees different. But it's so that's what intrigues me about it is we went from a situation of encouraging as much free speech as possible to I think a situation now where we're maybe limiting it, and I think it's a discussion that's worth having.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, John, what are your thoughts on differences between the free speech movement back in the 60s and what we're seeing today?
Well, let's look at the free speech movement. Jack mentioned Berkeley, the home of the free speech movement. There were actual marches by students and faculty to push the issue. This was, in essence, a rebellion against what they saw as constraints on liberty, constraints on their ability to argue about ideas, to engage the political process. Fast forward to today, and what we have now are people on campus making arguments that words are violence and that words are so impactful that they have to be restricted because they can offend one group or another group or another group. And that somehow the emotional toll is so great that universities allegedly have a vested interest in restricting what can be said or where it can be said or even ideas now that are conflictual or debatable. You have people on campus, students, faculty, administrators arguing and enacting policy sometimes that place restrictions on this, which – in my point of view, is anathema to higher education.
James, how crucial is free speech to higher education?
Well, I think it's fundamental to who we are. I mean, we've always been the place in society where there's always been this free exchange of ideas. And that's a part of why we exist, quite frankly, is to make sure that there's an avenue for those free exchanges to happen. So it's really fundamental to who we are.
What do you think? Is it a bit ironic that the University of California, Berkeley, considered the home of free speech, that it's been seeing, it's been a focal point for this latest battle over free speech?
Well, it doesn't surprise me. I mean, obviously, times have changed. Sensibilities of students have changed. The whole society has changed. And we talk about, you know, political correctness and how that has, you know, become in some ways overburdening to free speech ideas. But the bottom line is that the whole society has changed. And I think if we're not careful as academic institutions, we'll get swept up in it and lose sight of what our real sort of purpose and goal and sort of ultimate aim is. And that is to make sure that in fact, there's an opportunity for our students, our faculty, and our staff to engage in the search for truth. And that only happens when we can hear both sides, even things that we don't necessarily want to hear.
James brought up political correctness. That's part of it. What else is causing this, do you think? This debate to flare up like it has?
Well, it's an interesting question. There are those who suggest that just really in the last 2 years, the scene has changed dramatically on campus, and different causes are suggested. Helicopter parents are even brought into the picture, or there are those who would suggest that the students on campus today have been raised to give serious thought to what the bullying culture does to individuals and how to protect themselves from that. That probably has some relation to the political correctness issue.
Mm-hmm. Jack, what are your thoughts?
Well, I think those issues are part of it. I do think that one of the reasons I was very interested in this topic and presenting it through the Beyond Civility format is I do think that I obviously have a First Amendment bias. It's what I do for a living. And so I'm pretty rooted in the idea of the First Amendment and free speech. I've talked to people on the other side, though, and they feel very passionate the other way, that in fact, a speaker who is going to make offensive comments, who's going to have hateful thoughts, has no place on their campus because they don't feel that whatever, you know, state universities should be giving a platform to hateful speech. I disagree with that, but I do think that this is a topic that people tend to sometimes react almost reflexively. So the First Amendment person in me, sort of my almost knee-jerk reaction is, you know, no restrictions whatsoever. And some of the students who are in the middle of it, a more reflexive attitude is we can't allow people who are going to come on our campus speaking hateful and offensive sentiments that are going to upset people. We ought not give them a format. And both sides feel very strongly about it. And I think it's just because people feel so strongly and sort of automatically take their positions that I'm hoping that this event and this discussion will at least allow people to think about the other side's position both ways. I think it's important.
Is freedom of speech an absolute right, Jack?
Well, it's interesting when we talk about college campus because we are talking about really two separate entities. President Williams is at a private university. So the First Amendment really does not apply to Mount St. Joe. It does apply to University of Cincinnati and Miami University because they are state institutions. So there is a little bit of a difference. The First Amendment is not absolute. There are well-known restrictions, obscenity, things called fighting words, incitements. Fighting words being that, you know, if I were to get right in your face right now, Mark, and try to start a fight, that's a problem. And I'm not protected by the First Amendment.
Don't do that, Jack.
I won't. or things like incitement. If I tried to rile up the crowd here to, you know, pick up guns and go down to City Hall, that's not protected by the First Amendment. But when you get outside of those pretty narrow areas, it is a very broad right, a very broad protection.
John, go ahead, James.
I was going to say, and I agree with that, and the point that private institution is different. On the other hand, we still believe that First Amendment rights ought to be protected on our campus. As I said before, it's fundamental to who we are. So we want to invite folks to discuss all kinds of ideas. Having said that, because we are a private institution, I think we can be a little more discriminating, and I use that word advisedly, actually, in this instance, about who and what kinds of topics and subjects we might have, you know, discussed on our campus. The state, I think we want to make sure that we don't allow the state to crimp, you know, the First Amendment rights of individuals. On the other hand, as a private institution, I think it does make sense that there are some topics, some subjects, some discourse that we might not want to have on our campus. We think it's in the best interest of who we are and our students and our faculty and staff that certain topics might not be germane or appropriate, is a better word, for our campus, I think. And that does not mean that we don't think those are ideas our students ought to discuss. And there are opportunities, and we try to make sure we take advantage of those opportunities to make sure that our students get a sense of what some of those topics are and have an opportunity to discuss them civilly. And we do make every effort to make sure that that happens.
Now, does Mount St. Joseph's have a written policy, a formal policy about free speech?
We do. And a process for figuring out sort of who we would invite and how we would invite those persons, rather. But we still try to take each instance one at a time.
And John, what about UC? What's UC's policy concerning free speech?
I'm uncertain if they have a written policy now governing free speech activities, but I can tell you that historically, UC's commitment to free speech has been relatively minor. And when I arrived on campus, you know, 15 years ago or so, to have a free speech activity, you had to essentially apply for permission and then receive permission from some unknown bureaucrats down the chain. And then you were restricted to a very small section of campus in order to exercise those rights. That recently changed. The libertarian group was attempting to, I believe, collect signatures or pass out constitutions, something like this, and were prohibited, and I believe, if memory serves me correctly, threatened with arrest, and they sued in federal court. UC fought them, and UC lost, I'm happy to say. So now those restrictions are no longer in place, and it has had a remarkably transformative impact on campus. You now have competing voices right in the middle of campus sometimes. You have debate right in the middle of campus sometimes. And for all of the fears of disruption and all of the fears of incivility and impropriety, I would venture to say that the vast majority of those have gone unrecognized and that students have benefited tremendously from hearing multiple sides of arguments. And that has really opened up also other areas on campus, the creative areas. There was an anti-abortion protest not too long ago, followed almost immediately by a pro-choice protest in the same grounds, and that opened up other parts of campus, I think has had a tremendous impact.
Yeah, that was it. The UC situation was kind of interesting. It was Tim Black, the district court judge here and one of the federal judges in Cincinnati, that invalidated this provision that set up a free speech zone. And it was an area on campus, kind of remote, and that's where you could go to exercise your free speech rights. And Judge Black, I think, correctly said that the university is – essentially a public – it is public property. The sidewalks that you walk through are a public domain. And the idea of saying, well, you know, you can exercise your First Amendment right there but not here was just untenable. And he wrote a very thoughtful, I think, opinion on that.
I agree.
You know, Mark, I think there's often a lot of confusion between the issue of hate speech – as it relates to free speech. I think many people would suggest that hate speech, really denigrating a group of people openly and loudly, should be restricted. And in many countries, in most of the European countries and many of the Asian countries, it is restricted. They do have hate speech restrictions and laws. We don't, Jack, right?
That's correct.
Our First Amendment protects hate speech in a way, unless, as Jack pointed out earlier, there is the threat of violence or harm, physical harm.
And imminent. That's a very key provision, that it has to be, the threat has to be imminent, meaning that it is likely to result in violence in very short order. I think John can speak to this a little bit probably, that what I see happening to a certain degree is the sort of combining or conflating hate speech with hate ideas, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you've really witnessed this transformation in an argument that essentially said, okay, you know, we really do value civility, and we don't want to see people denigrated or groups denigrated and so forth, which is perfect. I think everyone around this table and people on campus agree with. Outside of prohibiting it, but now this argument has morphed into, well, certain ideas are impactful or even dangerous, and those ideas too have to be regulated because they're now classified as hateful. Of course, this is not just a slippery slope. This is a slippery slope with grease on it. Because it ultimately leads us to a point to where virtually any idea or can be regulated based upon someone's definition of that idea or how they feel about that idea or how it may impact somebody personally or emotionally. And again, this takes us places where the essence of being able to educate people, which requires us to be able to speak honestly to each other, oftentimes about very difficult ideas or situations, is limited. And it does not take much. It does not take much to have faculty shut down, to not speak on debatable issues, to sort of go underground. And I think education is thereby harmed when they do that.
And we will continue our conversation. You can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Caney. Joining us this afternoon to talk about free speech on campus, our senior mediator for the Center for Resolution of Disputes and co-founder of Beyond Civility, B. Larson, Mount St. Joseph University President, Dr. H. James Williams, Dr. John Paul Wright, professor in the University of Cincinnati School of Criminal Justice, and Jack Greiner, attorney with the Graydon Law Firm. He represents Inquirer Media and First Amendment and media issues. You can join us, 513-419-7100, email talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And let's talk to Wayne in Dayton. Hi, Wayne.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to ask your panel if they don't think that they're cherry-picking a little bit, as I've heard other discussions like this, and they always pick out Milo Yiannopoulos, Ann Coulter, and sometimes add Richard Spencer, none of which are welcome at CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Committee. Milo Yiannopoulos because of his stance on pedophilia, Ann Coulter because she's a pure provocateur, and Richard Spencer is a white supremacist. He goes to CPAC, but he's relegated to a vendor stand outside the main hall. So when you talk about anti-free speech in education, I find many times when you scratch the surface, what people are really saying is they don't like what their perceived liberal bias of the professors are. And they're trying to edge conservative values into the university, which is the true bastion of free speech. Thank you.
It's one of the important distinctions that we need to make as to just what the First Amendment, where the First Amendment applies and where it doesn't. And there has to be what is called state action. Jack, you can talk to that.
Well, yeah, the First Amendment only applies if there is state action. So again, a private university would not run afoul of the First Amendment if it—
Or CPAC.
Or CPAC, for that matter, right. I think that part of the question, I think part of the reason why Ann Coulter and Milo Yiannopoulos come up is just it's recent. I mean, there's just been some recency with it. But even more recent than that, John and I were talking on the way in, Senator John Corwin was disinvited to Texas Southern University. We certainly saw Betsy DeVos have a tough go of it at Bethune-Cookman. So, you know, it and I suspect that there are other situations that we don't always hear about. But to the caller's point, I don't know that we're cherry picking as much as we're just these are two of the more recent examples that have been pretty well publicized.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I would say, you know, free speech is not a conservative value or a liberal value. It's not restricted to one or either parties. It's a very traditional American value that our universities are supposed to protect and sort of lead the way on. And what we see today is, you know, if we're going to be directly honest, the people that are disinvited from universities are almost inevitably conservatives or libertarians. Forget Spencer or Ann Coulter or, you know, the people that are more inflammatory. You also have senators, prior secretaries of state that have also been disinvited. You've had people in business that have been disinvited because of their views on one thing or another.
But that's not to say that people who are liberal haven't faced the same thing.
Rarely. Let's just say this, that the biases on campus are pretty much left-leaning, and their values oftentimes take precedent over other values. And that's the real problem when it gets to the point that, you know, certain groups can say, you know, we don't want this person here because they don't represent our values. And what we have now are on many campuses, the people with the loudest voices get to, by default, tell other people what they can hear and whom they can hear it from.
Let's talk to Becky, who calls us from the Miami Valley here. Hi, Becky.
Hi.
Go right ahead.
Hello. Oh, I teach at a large community college, Sinclair Community College, in Dayton, Ohio, and I am at the forefront of all this because I teach English, composition mostly, and literature. And I tell my students at the beginning of the class every term, my entire class is a trigger. We're going to discuss issues because academia is the last place where you can have a civil conversation about abortion rights, about the, you know, gun control, about legalization of marijuana. And these are all issues we discuss, as well as very personal issues about how we grow and get formed. And I think I think students need to understand what a disservice it is when they try to shut down open conversation about these topics, even if they are very upsetting. And I had a student once years ago who had been, not in Ohio, but a different state, who'd been the victim of a rape. And this was before the whole trigger warning issue had come up. And she was actually upset with a piece of literature I gave her, which was about a rape, until she finished. And it helped her process issues she was dealing with herself, because that's what literature is supposed to do. And the idea of shutting down ideas in the one place where we're supposed to have an expansive dialogue with us.
Okay, I think
reprehensible.
There you go. We thought we'd lost you there for a moment there, Becky. James, let's have you weigh in on what Becky had to say there.
Well, I agree with her wholeheartedly. First of all, I don't have any problems with the trigger warning thing. I still don't think that should stand in the way of free speech. But the point is that if we can protect those who may be extra sensitive by making sure that there are some trigger warnings, I don't have a problem with that. I don't think it should shut down speech, though. I believe that we should have those kinds of conversations, like our caller just said, especially on a college campus, because that's one of the places where we really can have some civil conversations and actually help folks understand and appreciate what the different points of view are. And so I agree with the caller wholeheartedly.
We got an email from Randy. His point he wanted to make was that in the 90s, people could still have a civil debate, but now a lot of this is driven by social media and the popularity of out-of-control protests, the train wreck effect, he says. So he wonders what the panel thinks about social media, what it's done to speech on campus.
I think it threads on social media sometimes can take on a life of their own, and I think frequently they spiral to the lowest common denominator, unfortunately. But again, that's part of our open culture. It's a robust debate. It may not end in you know the best place, but I think that's part of the beauty, I think, of living in an open society.
Itself,
it really is, yeah. But it is unfortunate when people dig their heels in, and you know, I think you'll see like a lot of ad hominem arguments on social media. You know, you'll start with let's talk about tax reform, and all of a sudden, you know, somebody's being called a name that has nothing to do with the issue, and that's pretty disheartening. And I think people get a little disheartened by it, unfortunately.
I think the more I started to learn about this subject as we planned this program, I realized just how very complicated it is. It's not a simple issue. It's a complex one. We don't have anyone here today speaking from the perspective of the administration of these universities that have to deal with these issues. We will have on our panel the Dean of Students, Juan Guardia from UC. But the administration is faced with a need to be sensitive to student issues and to managing what could become a very expensive need to take what might happen at one of these speeches into consideration, and who's paying for the extra police forces, and who's it's a very complicated
very
issue.
Complicated, and I would imagine you can't just say how do we solve this, because there's just. It's just such a deep issue. Yeah,
let me address some of the research on social media use, for example, or media use and consumption, broadly speaking, right, pretty much tells us that given the diversity of media sources, people gravitate towards those sources that confirm their views. We associate primarily with people of similar political ilk. We form little cliques, and we're oftentimes galvanized to action based upon threats to the groups that we belong to. The other side of that is we look at other groups who may have competing claims as not simply wrong, but now even immoral. And this is threading through our conversations, and universities should be places where those groups can come together, discuss their differences, learn from each other, and have those difficult conversations, right? Be able to communicate, even if it sometimes does lead to the, you know, the ad hominem or the lowest common denominator, there's an educational value to this. And to reduce bias and to reduce unnecessary stereotyping, what the research tells us is that it happens when people are in proximity to each other who hold different views. When universities shut this down or emphasize our differences or put us off into groups, right, what they're actually doing is creating much of the problem that they're trying to work around.
Let's talk to Derek in Glendale. Hi, Derek.
Hello, how are you?
Good, thank you.
His statement tonight, and maybe see that your callers will maybe address it. Several years ago, Mitt Romney announced that corporations are people. Do you remember this?
Yes.
Do you remember this? Him stating that corporations or businesses are people, right? So it seems to me, and again, maybe I'm wrong, but I want to see if maybe your guests will address it. If an organization wants to be defined as a group that's experiencing hate speech or a group of people, all they have to do is establish themselves as a people group and then say, well, that person or persons is leveling hate speech. So I'm wondering now, at what point, or is it possible that organizations, corporations can say that someone is exhibiting hate speech towards them since they're now defined as people? Also, you have organizations like NAMBLA, which is really a cousin but still in the closet of the LGBT, and this organization is advocating pedophilia. So what do the legal people there have to say about the possibility that organizations and or groups like this could define themselves as people groups and then say that we're experiencing hate speech?
Well, there's a little bit already in place. The Supreme Court has recognized that even a state or a state institution itself has First Amendment rights. And that's kind of important because, for example, the state of Alabama can and did, you know, erect a statue to Martin Luther King at the bridge at Selma. That was a choice that Alabama made. They are not required to balance that out by building a statue to George Wallace. So that's a good thing. And again, a University of Cincinnati, Miami University, can choose which speakers to invite to campus and choose not to invite speakers. Where the rub has come, where the challenge has come, is where individual groups on campus invite a speaker. So it's not really University of Cincinnati inviting the speaker. It's the college libertarians at University of Cincinnati inviting a speaker. So to your point, there actually is a First Amendment right that an institution has in some respects. So I think you're on to something, but the law is, to a certain extent, there already.
Let's get one last call in here. This is from Adam in Dayton. Hi, Adam.
Hello. I was just wondering if you thought that your use of, like, trigger warnings and, like, the phrase of it was too general, because, for example, the use of trigger warnings in classrooms is often used for, like, warnings of upcoming difficult content rather than, like, to quash discussion, whereas, the use of political correctness in regards to, like, Milo Yiannopoulos and things like that are for, like, perceived legitimate, like, reduction in hate speech that can normalize bad behavior.
So I guess the question is, are trigger warnings helpful or are they harming free speech?
And then the answer is complicated. I don't think we can be doctrinaire about that.
James?
Yeah, like I said earlier, I don't have a problem with the trigger warnings at all. I agree with the caller that, and it's an opportunity to try to forewarn somebody that we're going to talk about some difficult topics, but we're going to talk about them nonetheless. And then you can decide whether you want to be a part, whether you want to participate. I think that's fine. I think that's fair. I think that's reasonable. So I don't have a problem with trigger warnings, and I don't think that they're necessarily hurting us. I think the problem is that if we think that the only time somebody can speak freely is if they have already in advance told us that, you know, these are some things that I might want to talk about that might hurt somebody's feelings, because sometimes you don't even know sort of what the sensibilities of the persons with whom you're speaking or the persons who might be in that audience. That's the difficult part of it. And so as long as we don't allow that to stand in the way of persons coming and having the opportunity to speak freely about particular topics, I don't see it as a real problem.
John?
I hold a slightly different view. I always tell my students that my classes are entirely triggering and that they're not safe places for them. And I say that sort of tongue-in-cheek sometimes. That said, you know, there's this ongoing, I think, effort sometimes to see students, to see college students not as the adults that they are, but as sort of extended children or people in extended childhood. And I think that it's just simply better to treat them as adults, to say, look, these are the books that we're going to read. Some of these ideas may be a bit difficult, but we're going to plow through them. This is the place where we can do that. And part of being a responsible adult is being able to look at difficult issues, discuss difficult issues honestly, and revise your views when the evidence isn't in your way.
Bea, tell us about the event that's coming up Tuesday, Beyond
Yes.
Civility.
Next Tuesday night, the 30th.
Okay.
Our event will be held at St. John's Unitarian Church in Clifton, and we invite everyone to register. The program, the reception starts at 5:30. The program actually starts at 6:30 and will end at about 8:30. And I just would like to add that we do have a student on our panel. None of us here are able to present that perspective, and I think it's an important perspective for us to hear.
And you can find more information about that event at WVXU.org. James, John, Jack, and Bea, thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you. It's awesome.
Senior mediator for the Center for Resolution of Disputes and co-founder of Beyond Civility, B. Larson, Mount St. Joseph University President Dr. H. James Williams, Dr. John Paul Wright, professor in the University of Cincinnati School of Criminal Justice, and Jack Greiner, attorney with the Graydon Law Firm.